Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms with your hosts, me, Padraig Reedy and Neil Denny. Our guest this week is Guardian's Alok Jha, and I will hand straight over to Neil Denny to introduce Alok.
Thanks, Padraig. Alok Jha is science and environment correspondent at The Guardian newspaper. In addition to writing news and comment, he presents the Science Weekly podcast. He runs the Guardian Science website and he graduated with a physics degree from Imperial College London. And tonight we're going to be talking about Alok's first book, which is called How to Live Forever and 34 Other Really Interesting Uses of Science. So, Alok, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about the book. What was the idea behind it, I suppose, we should start with?
It's quite a wide-ranging book, isn't it? I mean, it's 35 chapters, and my attempt was to try and distill down everything I know about science into less than 200 pages, which you might find incredible because, you know, there is so much science, and it's funny how it all fits into such a small little book, isn't there? But actually, I mean, I've got a very lucky job. I meet very interesting people. I talk to them all the time, as you mentioned, on the podcast or for the paper, cover stories all the time, and there's just so much stuff out there that's just fascinating. Unfortunately, I love reading and doing it, so this was an attempt to distill some of the most interesting stuff into a book for people who are interested in science but don't feel like they know lots about it. So it's an attempt to give them a handle on lots of different concepts.
So, yeah, there's 34 different subjects that you cover, and there's
35.
Yeah, sorry,
of course.
And 34
Maths
other.
Is one of them,
so
by the
yeah,
way.
We should include How to Live Forever in that. So what we're going to do is we're just going to basically choose a load of those topics at random, and I've tried to choose a few that we haven't necessarily discussed on the show before. So the first one is we should talk first of all about the title subject of the book, which is How to Live Forever. So how do we live forever?
Well, it's a good question. That chapter, so each chapter is basically the header is a question which is a question which can be solved and attacked by science. And essentially, you can solve almost anything with science, but the idea is that you don't necessarily get to the answer, but it shows you a way of thinking. It takes you somewhere along the lines of what that problem means. Because I think sometimes people think science is just a set of facts, when in fact it's a way of thinking. And all of these questions are, how would you answer that question? So, How to Live Forever. And by the way, the publisher chose that title because it seems to be the one that everyone likes the best. But essentially, it's about the remarkable achievements of medicine, evidence-based medicine. What we start off with is trying to understand what makes someone or something die. Is it something in your genes? Is it something to do with gradual decay? And over time, over the past 50 years or 100 years, as we've learned more biology, as we've actually studied ourselves more, as technology to study gets better, we realize that actually there's no program in the genes, really. There's a few things that make your cells not divide after a certain point in time to protect them from getting cancer, becoming cancerous. But other than that, there's nothing that says, right, at this point, you're going to die. So instead, what it is, it's life. Life kills you. You build up toxins. And I know that on this podcast, it's probably a bad word, isn't it? Toxins. And all of that. But what I mean by that is poisons. Things. Whenever your metabolic processes happen, you get byproducts, and those byproducts end up doing you damage. That's essentially what it is. Oxygen, which we need to live, it's a ravaging molecule. It kills everything that comes anywhere near. And so you do need things that protect that, and the body has lots of really good ways of doing that. But eventually the arms race loses, and you just build up so many of these things that you just die. And that's what death is. And so my attempt was to find, right, what can we do to mop up this stuff, these poisons? What can we do to rebuild bones that break? What can we do to regrow organs? And what you get is a story about stem cell research. You get a story about understanding how the body functions. It's about drugs. It's about all the stuff. It's essentially, Ben Golding will probably love this, it's a celebration of evidence-based medicine.
William Burroughs used to have a theory that on-off heroin addiction was the secret to eternal life.
It probably makes it go better, doesn't it? If nothing else. Because, I mean, there's always that thing, isn't there? Because there's an ethical question at the end of this. If you could do all of this stuff, Aubrey de Grey, people like that, the guy with the beard, he reckons that you can probably live to 1,000 mm-hmm. if you have technologies, if you just focus your technologies onto it, and there are institutes out there focused on doing this stuff. And that's fantastic. I love the idea that those people are out there doing this stuff. But actually, if you could live to 1,000, would you want to? I mean, you'd just be probably, it would be a horrible, sort of slightly incontinent existence for the last 500. Why would you want to do that?
Well, my next question was going to be that really we already have that situation in that, you know, life expectancies have changed massively over, you know, over the past century, and now people do regularly live to 100. But we are still in the situation where the, you know, the science of keeping people alive, inequality of life, has not kept up with the you know, the science of fighting the diseases. So, you know, we do live probably a bit of a, you know, a bit of a rubbish last 30 years of our life if we live beyond 70. So if we can't live forever, what have we done to sort of improve the quality of our life, I suppose, is my question.
Well, think about it. As you say, there's no point living forever or living a long, long time if the last third of your life is just a miserable pain for yourself and for everyone around you. So the sort of goal of this sort of research, aging research, is to understand aging and to give you a long, healthy life and then make the end very quick. That's what we all want, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And so what's medicine done to make you the end of your life better? I mean, think about, turn the question around, what's medicine done to make the rest of your life better for longer? So you can get statins to reduce your cholesterol. You can get so many drugs and treatments now for cancer that cancer is no longer necessarily a fatal disease. It's becoming, our understanding of cancer is getting to such an extent where it's becoming a disease you live with in many respects, and still there's lots to do on cancer. The idea that you can take aspirin every day just to keep your sort of heart ticking over and your blood thinned to reduce the clots, that sort of stuff, it keeps you incrementally feeling better all the time. And also, let's not forget the basic stuff. Eat your greens, don't smoke, exercise. You can't get away from this stuff. As much as you want a magic pill to sort everything out, that's what you really need to do. So one of the scientists I spoke to for this book, and for The Guardian a while ago, said, look, it's all about the quality of the bodywork at the beginning. You know, you can have a really good Rolls Royce. If you look after it, it'll stay a good Rolls Royce for a long time. If you start off with a Lada, then it's going to fall apart much more quickly.
Just slightly tangentially from the book, is there a problem with mainstream health and science journalism that we're always looking for something else that isn't the rather dull, don't smoke, go for a walk every so often and eat your greens?
Yeah, I mean, how many times do you want to hear that? Yeah. We should know it, right? Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, newspapers, it's all about novelty. Something's happened, something new has happened. Either you turn over some paradigm or you create a new one, and that's what we really live on. And so any tiny sort of wrinkle, that will get reported as slightly out of proportion. I think it's something that I'm sure you guys talk about all the time, and we bemoan as well, to be honest with you. What is more interesting about all this stuff is that there are different ways of doing this now. So you're supposed to eat healthily and you're supposed to exercise and stuff, but you can report on things which are how much exercise, you know, what kinds of exercise works for different people, how you can get motivated. I didn't talk in this book, but one thing about living better, a lot of it's about cognitive behaviour. I mean, how much do you want to do this stuff? How do you persuade yourself to do it? How to keep things fresh? These are all really interesting ideas that I think we're going to develop over the next 20, 30, 40 years.
So we should probably not bother with that Little Atoms branded detox set of
I think
products.
You should sell it. Look, the point is, none of your listeners will buy it, but everyone else will. So you'll make a fortune. The fact it doesn't work doesn't stop people buying this sort of stuff, does it?
All right, well, let's change the subject completely, move on to our next chapter from the book, and let's talk about how we become invisible.
This is fun, isn't it? This is proper weird hardcore physics. I mean, the inevitable thing whenever anyone talks about becoming invisible is Harry Potter, and what's that? Is it Star Trek? The Klingons, they manage to cloak their ships, and it would be great, wouldn't it, to make things invisible? Or, I don't know, would it? But the point is what I was trying to explain with this chapter is just, This is just how light works and how we see things. So we take things for granted. We take seeing for granted. I see this desk in front of me. Now, why is it I'm seeing it? It's because the light above me emits light waves. It bounces off the sort of the surface, and some of those waves scatter into my eyes. That's how I see it. If this desk wasn't there, or if the light wasn't there, I wouldn't see this thing, and for me that would be invisible. So what scientists are trying to do is make materials which bend light in very odd, strange ways. That means that the objects that they're sort of in front of will seem invisible to you only because the light doesn't get into your eyes. It's not that they're not there or they're doing something weird, cloaky thing to it. It's just the light is bent around it. The best analogy I've heard is imagine a rock in the middle of a stream, a fast-flowing stream, and you're downstream of that thing. Now, when the water from upstream hits the rock, it goes around it and then joins up again on the other side, and then when you see the water downstream, you see it as straight. You don't know there's a rock there. In sense, that rock is essentially invisible to you.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the technology that's been developed to do this. You know, the refraction of the light. There's something called metamaterials.
Yeah, this is a triumph of physics, really. I mean, it started off with a guy called John Pendry at Imperial College in London. He's a theoretical physicist, a genius who started to think about how light bends in different media. Mm-hmm. And so what happens when light goes from one medium to another, say air to glass? It bends, it refracts. And so what he thought, well, and every material has a refractive index. This tells you how much it bends. So refractive indices are usually positive, because if you go from less dense to more dense, the light wave bends in, if you like. So what he thought was, what if you could get a material that has a negative refractive index? It bends the wrong way. And so he postulated this stuff, and several years later in the States and elsewhere, people actually made this stuff. And what you essentially do is you build these really intricate patterns, tiny, tiny sort of patterns on surfaces which just scatter the light in all sorts of places. And the intricacy that these materials are built upon, these little mosaics, will scatter different wavelengths of light. So at the moment, what they've been able to do really well is scatter radio waves, for example. And for that, you need features on your surface which are about a centimetre or so. To do anything... Oh, no, not centimetre, millimetres, what am I talking about? To do visible waves, which are many orders of magnitude smaller than radio waves, you need even tinier things. So you can see it's a technological challenge. Not impossible, but a technological challenge nonetheless. And this stuff is incredibly expensive. Now, even since this book, stuff's moved on. I mean, just a few months ago, some guys in Birmingham University did this amazing thing without using metamaterials at all. They just used a crystal of calcite, just a lump of calcite, which essentially bent the waves around in certain ways, which meant that a paperclip behind it was completely invisible to the person on the other side of the calcite. Now, you know, hiding paperclips is one thing. Hiding warships is probably another.
Well, just to explain that slightly more, because... you know, if this cup is the calcite and this piece of paper is the paperclip, well, I can't see it because there's a lump of calcite in front of it.
That's right, but calcite, bear in mind, the calcite they used is a clear crystal, so you can see through it. And so what they were able to do is use polarised light to bend, so essentially the light coming through it, some of it didn't get to you, essentially. Actually explaining it would take a degree in physics I do have a degree in physics, but it would be too hard for me to try and explain it.
In a couple of minutes.
And it doesn't really work on radio. But there is a video on our website if you want to know more about it. You can go and read about it there. But what I'm saying, my point being, that this stuff is so cutting edge that you can write a book about it, 6 months later it's out of date.
You listen to Little Atoms with Neil Denny, Patrick Reedy, and our guest, Alok Jha. We've reached the halfway point of the programme, and let's move on to the next topic, which... predictably or unpredictably, is how do we predict the unpredictable?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have this idea of science being very predictable. It's about mechanistic universes. Well, at least it was in the 19th century before quantum mechanics came along. But we're not talking about quantum mechanics here. This is about chaos theory. Now, you've probably all heard of chaos theory. I'm sure you associate it with butterfly effects and all those sorts of things. And what chaos theory is this, the fact that... At the sort of basic level, say something like the atmosphere, it's explainable by physics. they're just atoms and molecules bumping into each other and moving around. And you can predict, if you took two of these atoms and looked at how they're moving around, you could pretty much predict everything they're going to do because they're just obeying Newton's laws, essentially. Unfortunately, there are billions and billions of these things in just every cubic centimetre. So how on earth do you predict what that cubic centimetre of gas is going to do? You can't. So there are some methods, for example, of statistically working out pressures and all of those things. That's a different subject and became thermodynamics in the end. But then when it comes to massive, massive scale things like atmospheres or oceans or that kind of thing, and in fact things like human behaviour or animal behaviour, evolution, how would you predict something like that? I mean, ultimately you can if you could model every single thing, but it's just not possible. So chaos theory came along in the middle of the 20th century, actually, which seems late for a scientific theory that everyone seems to know about. Mm-hmm. It came along in the 60s when someone was looking at the atmosphere and how to sort of predict weather. And chaos theory is used to sort of predict what happens in big weather systems. It's also used as a way of trying to work out, as I mentioned before, how very complicated evolutionary systems, ecosystems might progress. And it's proved quite sort of successful, really, because even though it's unpredictable, if you let go of that worry about unpredictability, you find patterns, and that's what these guys look for. So there is pattern in unpredictability.
You talk about strange attractors, which I'd like to talk about because my friend has a journal called that, and I don't know what it means.
This is Mark Pilkington.
It is indeed.
Yeah, that's right. Mark Pilkington, yeah, who also is a genius. Actually, I'm a big fan of his. Strange attractors. Yeah, these are patterns that despite them something being chaotic, a system being chaotic, i.e., unpredictable. You find that if you let them loose for a while, different systems will attract themselves to different positions, different states. Mm-hmm. And they won't be stable in those states, but they will go around those states. So, for example, one strange attractor looks something like... it looks a bit like a butterfly. It's something to do with the butterfly effect, by the way. It looks like a butterfly because it's as if something's oscillating in this pattern. And if you look at this diagram, it's on page 118 of the book if you want to look, and available on Wikipedia too, probably, if you look there. And essentially what it does is you can see lots and lots of lines. It looks like lots of concentric circles, ovals, really. And this is the path taken by a variable as it moves round and round in this chaotic system. No, it never repeats the same path twice, but you see that it essentially maps out this pattern, this beautiful pattern, actually. And there are lots and lots of different types of strange attractors, and what these things are mathematical constructs. They're ways of extracting some order out of this so you can predict what this system is going to do. So different systems attract themselves to different attractors.
So it's sort of saying that although there's within itself it's incredibly chaotic on a sort of wider level,
want to sort of get extract information. You can extract information out of this stuff. It's not completely crazy, is what I'm saying. The weather, we know, it's completely unpredictable, actually, but you can still kind of predict it, mm-hmm. even though you can't predict even every single individual bit. And I think that scientists realised, ever since, I suppose, the quantum revolution, and with this as well, that you don't necessarily need to know every single mechanism to still be able to know what kind of happens afterwards.
Okay, so let's move on to the next subject because it's entirely linked, and chaos theory came out of trying to study the weather, and you have a chapter called How to Control the Weather. So let's talk about ways in which, we've said, the weather is incredibly difficult to predict, but now we're going to talk about, how we would actually go about affecting and making changes.
It sounds ridiculous, actually, doesn't it? The idea that you'd be able to control something like the weather. The weather changes. I was going to say the weather changes every day. Of course it does. That's a silly thing to say. I meant here in Britain, the weather seems to be completely mad every day. It can be different. Look at what weather is. Weather is essentially the movements and the patterns of air currents in the lower part of the atmosphere. And what it is, it's the movement of energy. The sun shines on the Earth at different intensities across different parts of the Earth, and the air moves it around, the water moves it around, and what the effects of that are, essentially, it becomes weather. So everything we know of, hurricanes, rainfall, all these things are determined by the way that these different things move around. And, we've understood a lot about the weather. And you know, as technology gets better, we've known about these sort of trade winds for hundreds of years. People have used them to travel around the world. These are essentially fundamental parts of the way that the Earth works, the Earth's atmosphere rather works. And so how can you, understanding it is one thing, you can then start to tinker around with it if you know how. And predictably, there have been experiments in secret in all sorts of places. If you, for example, if you want to make it rain, you could try something called cloud seeding. What happens is if you fire lots of aerosol, very small particles, into the atmosphere, like either dry ice or silver iodide, what happens is that around those, any vapor up there, water vapor, will latch onto those things, creating a cloud, essentially an artificial cloud. Mm-hmm. And if there is enough water vapor up there, it will rain that down, and you'll get rain. This has not been confirmed, but apparently the Chinese tried this before the Olympics being held in Beijing, because they didn't want it to rain on the opening ceremony, so they fired all the stuff up out there to try and suck the skies free of water. You can do other things as well. There was a project called Storm Fury, which is a great name, run from the 1960s to the 1980s by the US government. And what they tried to do is try to disrupt the structure of the winds around the Atlantic by throwing supercooled water up into the atmosphere. And the idea there was that if you could get rid of some of the heat, and bear in mind, hot ocean, hot sea surface temperature, hot air is the thing that causes hurricanes and typhoons and things. Mm-hmm. If you can cool it down somehow, then it wouldn't. Then actually, the winds wouldn't happen. The storms wouldn't happen. The problem is you can't really test whether it worked or not, because it's such a huge system. And how much can you put up there as humans? You'd have to be putting it up there all day long to actually have any effect. And actually, they stopped it in the end because they thought, well, actually, the storms seem to go down, but it might have just happened anyway. By itself. I mean, the number of storms happening in the Atlantic and other places is increasing because of climate change. And actually, to be honest, we've done a lot of weather control accidentally through that. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see lots more storms. And that we've done it in exactly the way that you would do the other way around if you wanted to have fewer storms. I.e., we've put more carbon into the atmosphere, it's got hotter, more storms.
Yeah. Okay, I want to just talk about one more topic from the book. This is how to think like an ant. I'd like to spend the last few minutes of the podcast talking about...
You said you were really interested in this one. Tell me why. I mean, I'll tell you why. This is one of my favourite chapters.
Yeah, I mean, mine as well. And it was just... It's the idea of the superorganism, which was the thing I particularly wanted to pick out. And it's just not a concept I'd come across before, so I was absolutely fascinated by it. But first of all, talk about, you know, what's... Is there something special about the way that ants think? You know, why to the title of this chapter?
Well... Ants themselves, little insects, don't really do much thinking. They're just automatons. They move around through hormonal chemical signals, essentially. The other ants send signals about that way is better food, this way is back to the hive, over there is danger, and they just go along with that. The interesting thing about the way that ants have survived is that they've been around for millions of years, long before we or any of our primate ancestors considered walking around on two legs. They were developing a eusocial society, this sort of altruistic sort of society that, you know, none of our primate ancestors really knew anything about. What I meant by the way they think is the way that collection of automatons, the one that either they don't have any collective intelligence, the way that some emergent property comes out of it, which is that they're incredibly successful. They've colonized every single niche in the world apart from Antarctica. Mm-hmm. They're much more successful on Earth than we are, if you think about the sort of numbers and the sort of where they are. And for anyone not familiar with ant societies, essentially each ant has a specific job. So some are foragers, some look for food, some protect the nest. There's one queen that sort of decides, has all the babies. Essentially, and they're an incredible sort of the division of labour is incredible.
But there's not much social mobility in the ant world.
I don't think there is. Well, because they're physically different. These ants are. It's decided from birth what they're going to do. All the males are killed off, by the way. None of us would survive in an ant world, probably for the best. But there are some soldiers, of course, that do the fighting. They're all females, sterile females, apart from the queen. They're successful. Let's just say if we can say that they're successful, that's where they are. Now, why are they successful? It's because of this sort of incredible... sort of extreme communist society. None of them complain about the fact that they're in these roles. That's what they do. You know, it's like, what was it? Is it E.O. Wilson, who is one of my sort of heroes. I'm sure that for many of your listeners too. He kind of said, communism, socialism is a great idea. It's just got the wrong species. And it's because ants do this. Ants do this, and they're so good at it. It's such a great way to live and be successful. And what I found really fascinating about it was that E.O. Wilson and his colleague in Arizona State, called Bert Hodobler, they came up with this idea of a superorganism. I mean, it's been around a little bit before, but it's that each individual ant is what it is. It's just a little insect. But together, this entire colony is what he calls a superorganism, which can sort of go out there, take risks. Hundreds of them can die and go to some place. It doesn't matter. The point is that the hive will survive. We can't do that. We're one organism. We don't want to lose an arm necessarily to find food or whatever. And in fact, that this is a very successful strategy. Different parts of the organism can go out and find food in different places, but they're all looking out for the organism. And in a sense, it also models something very interesting. It models, some people think, using ant colonies as sort of models for human brains. Because if you think about it, there's a parallel. Every one of our neurons in the brain is not intelligent. None of them are intelligent, rather. They're just essentially controlled by hormones and other chemicals, and they just work in networks. But together, we have consciousness. Out of that, you get consciousness, you get cognitive thought, all this stuff. And you can quite nicely model brains using ants. I mean, that's just fascinating, I think. It's just at the beginning, that stuff. But the people in Bristol doing that right now.
You sort of you make the comparison of an individual ant to basically like an individual cell in a human body in the superorganism idea.
Yeah, so in that one, different ants do different things. Say, for example, I'll just read out a quote here. Bert Hodobler, Arizona State, who's E.O. Wilson's partner in crime on this, he says, a superorganism is a closely knit group that divides labour amongst its members altruistically. There are individuals who reproduce, who are promoted to be reproducers, those who don't reproduce. This allows the whole thing to function as a giant organism. Think of it as a dispersible creature that can stretch out limbs to be in many places at once, go out to forage for food, and then withdraw into the nest after raking up whatever's around. And so, you know, like we have specialised cells. All of our cells have the same DNA, apart from the gametes, of course. But certain, they just have specialised functions. So the blood cells, brain cells, liver cells, heart cells, whatever. It's the same with an ant. It's just that the ants have physically different characteristics to do their specific functions. In some ant societies, for example, the atta ant, the one that's famous holding up the leaf and all of that, the one that I'm sure everyone kind of knows about, there are different grades of ant depending on what specifically they're going to do. So some of them bring the leaves back in, others chop it up into bits. Slightly smaller ones chop those up into smaller bits. Slightly smaller ones chop those smaller bits into smaller bits. Then even smaller ones take those little tiny bits, feed them to the sort of farmed animals they keep, the aphids that they keep, which they then milk for sugar, which then they eat. I mean, how complex is that as an organization? That's just evolution for you. We didn't go into evolution in this, but I mean, that's what evolution can do over millions of years, and it's so much more interesting than intelligent design, isn't it?
Great, terrifying sci-fi dystopia. That's right. What it sounds like. It's
so
doing.
Much more interesting, but you'd never think to do that if you're an intelligent designer. You're kind of, I don't know why we've got onto this all of a sudden, but my point being that's just one of the millions of different species of ants that there are, not millions, thousands and thousands of species. That's how complex they are, and that's how specialised they can be.
We're out of time, so Alok, thank you very much for coming.
Sorry
in.
Sorry if I've outtalked you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.